Bosnia. I mean, for example, in Bosnia, over the course of its 4-year war, there were something like 7 or 8,000 children killed, which is terrible. In Gaza, over the course of just 6 months, there have been more than 13,000 children killed. So, I just could not help but see not only the parallels, but also how what seems to be unfolding in Gaza is even worse than what I saw in Bosnia.
And we have less than a minute left, but I'm wondering your perspective on how the U.S. media has been covering the war in Gaza.
It's been a real mixed bag, and it was a real mixed bag in Bosnia. And we're all kind of captives of our experiences, and so I covered the war in Bosnia. I also covered other wars, so I may be talking too much about Bosnia, but I think it is relevant. In Bosnia, there was exceptionally good coverage, I think, and I'm biased on this, but I think from the journalists who were on the ground, largely foreign journalists, but also a lot of Bosnian journalists, really good coverage of actually what was going on. But then in the foreign capitals, in Washington, D.C., but also London and France, France and Britain were very important elements of the international community at the time. The reporting was terrible because it reflected the kind of briefings that the journalists were getting from all their government sources and all the think tank people, and they were just saying, oh, it's a
We
mess
have
there. These
15
people want
seconds,
to kill each
Peter.
other. So we have the same problem now where there's a lot of bad coverage coming out of the capitals, such as Washington, although from the ground itself, reporting is quite
You are
excellent.
listening to
We want to thank you,
KBOO
sir.
Portland on 90.7 FM.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. KBOO's Board of Directors meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Here at KBOO, this upcoming April 22nd, we will be celebrating Earth Day by taking a moment to celebrate nature and by bringing you special programming all day, featuring interviews with activists and nonprofit leaders and covering issues such as ecological justice, environmental awareness, climate activism, animal rights advocacy, and the indigenous concept of Mother Earth. Again, tune in this upcoming Earth Day, April 22nd, for a celebration of all things nature, environmental awareness, animal rights advocacy, and climate activism here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the newly appointed czar of Multnomah County Homeless Response turns in his resignation amid allegations of bullying women employees. Portland agrees to appoint a new independent monitor to oversee its policing settlement with the Department of Justice. And in national news, former President Donald Trump's hush money trial begins. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, April 16th, 2024. I'm Michelle Coppola. The newly appointed homelessness czar for Multnomah County, Chris Fick, has resigned. This comes as Willamette Week was preparing a story about allegations by six former and current county staffers about how he bullied women employees at the county. Fisk was previously County Chair Jessica Vega Peterson's chief of staff before being appointed to lead the county's homeless initiatives recently. Vega Peterson asked for his resignation Monday, and he agreed. Vega Peterson told Willamette Week in an email, quote, I wanted to share with you directly that I asked Chris to resign, and he did so. I'm committed to building a team that is in line with my values and the values of Multnomah County. It has become clear to me that changes were needed. While there have not been any findings of wrongdoing, I want to make sure that these issues don't distract from the critical work at hand." End quote. Fisk denies the, quote, general allegations and says the county did not tell him there was a pattern of behavior related to bullying women employed at the county. He received around $25,000 in severance pay and 1 month of health insurance coverage. For the present, Ryan Dibert will act as the interim leader of the county homeless response system. There's a new independent monitor in town charged with overseeing the City of Portland's settlement with the U.S. Department of Justice. MPS and Associates, led by Mark P. Smith, will be the new independent monitor of the settlement agreement on policing. Smith is the Los Angeles Police Department Inspector General. The team also includes Antoinette Edwards, the former director of the Portland Office of Youth and Violence Prevention. The settlement agreement dates back to 2015, when the Justice Department found that Portland police had a pattern of using excessive force against people experiencing mental illness. In the years since then, that's meant that the DOJ has had extra oversight over changes at the police bureau. The Portland police have adopted new training and created new teams to try to better handle someone experiencing mental distress when they're out on a call. The settlement agreement was set to expire in 2021, but the crowd control tactics used by Portland police in response to racial justice protesters in 2020 meant they were out of compliance with the Justice Department. The settlement agreement was extended as a result. The city has settled multiple lawsuits with people who were subjected to excessive force at that time and in the years since. The new independent monitor is in charge of monitoring the PPB's practices and reporting back to the DOJ about whether the police bureau is complying with the changes the Justice Department wants them to make. The official vote to name MPS and Associates as independent monitor will be at the City Council meeting on May 2nd. In national news, former President Trump's hush money trial begins. Indigenous communities call on the UN to shut down a hazardous pipeline. And SCOTUS will hear oral arguments about whether prosecutors overstepped when charging January 6th insurrectionists. With more on those stories, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
This is political persecution. This is a persecution like never before. Nobody's ever seen anything like it. And again, it's a case that should have never been brought.
No jurors were picked on the first day of selection in former President Donald Trump's hush money trial, the first criminal proceeding against any president in office or out. Trump is repeating his line that it's election interference for him to be prosecuted for falsifying business records to cover up payments after sex with a porn star. Finding an unbiased jury could take some time. White House and Pentagon officials are dismissing a report that Iran alerted the U.S. before attacking Israel. Almost all of the 300 drones and missiles used in Saturday night's strike had no effect, although Iran is calling it a great victory. The Biden administration is pressing Israel not to overreact, even as the right inside and outside that government are pressing for a fierce response. National Security spokesman John Kirby says Israel can look to new international sanctions on Iran's missile programs.
We will be working to further isolate Iran internationally and increase economic and other forms of pressure. So that's the upshot here. A stronger Israel, a weaker Iran, a more unified alliance of partners.
Today, the Supreme Court hears oral arguments on whether January 6th insurrectionists can be charged with obstruction for trying to block an official proceeding. Defense attorneys argue that's a stretch. A ruling is expected in June and could impact a separate criminal case pending against Trump. Louisiana lawmakers passed a bill requiring poster-sized Ten Commandment displays in all public school classrooms, despite the Supreme Court ruling that's unconstitutional. A 2-year-old law already requires posting the phrase, "In God We Trust." State Representative Dodie Horton insists they're not favoring any one faith.
I have no qualms if it was. This is not preaching a Christian religion. It's not preaching any religion. It's teaching a moral code.
Census data finds almost 25 million black and brown eligible voters are missing from registration databases. An analysis says people of color are being systematically sidelined by seemingly inclusive voter engagement systems. And Prentice Haney with the Ohio Organizing Collaborative says that compounds those citizens' existing mistrust.
Over time, they actually fall off the list and they're not even in the conversation. And what we see in America is that those voters tend to be black voters and brown voters and people of color. And it's not because those voters are disengaged. They're cynical about the system.
Native Americans are asking the United Nations to press the U.S. and Canada to shut down the Enbridge Line 5 oil and gas pipeline. Whitney Gravel with the Bay Mills Indian Community says the permanent forum on Indigenous issues already called for decommissioning of the pipeline running under the straits between Lake Huron and Lake Michigan.
The permanent forum also stated that it jeopardizes the Great Lakes in the United States, that the pipeline was a real and credible threat to the treaty-protected resources of Indigenous peoples in both the United States and Canada.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Today is National Healthcare Decisions Day. Experts recommend that people consider medical care decisions with their loved ones before it becomes impossible to do so. Eric Tegedoff has more.
It's National Healthcare Decisions Day, which highlights the importance of planning for the future when it comes to medical choices. In particular, the organization Compassion and Choices is focused on end-of-life decisions and ensuring that people discuss advanced care planning with their loved ones and healthcare team. Megan Williams is Clinical Engagement and Education Program Manager with the organization.
Talking about your end-of-life plans, your advanced care plans, you're giving your loved ones and the people around you an opportunity to feel confident that they are following your wishes as they continue to support you through your journey.
Oregon is one of 10 states where medical aid in dying is legal. Planning for health care as people age is likely to become more important in the coming decades. The number of people with Alzheimer's disease, the most common form of dementia, is projected to double from 7 million today to 14 million in 2050. Jessica Impenu, National Director of Clinical Engagement and Education with Compassion and Choices, says it can be hard to make health decisions once the disease has progressed.
Because dementia has this characteristic where at some point an individual will lose their ability to communicate their wants, their needs, their wishes, making those decisions and completing the important legal documents in advance of that cannot be underscored enough.
On Compassion and Choices' website is the Dementia Values and Priorities tool. Impenu says this can be useful to help people communicate their wishes to loved ones.
Because dementia has this characteristic where at some point an individual will lose their ability to communicate their wants, their needs, their wishes, making those decisions and completing the important legal documents in advance of that cannot be underscored enough.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
In more health news, insulin price gouging is a persistent issue in the United States, even after federal lawmakers have taken action to cap the costs of the medicine for people on Medicare. Insulin is a hormone that regulates blood sugar in the body. That includes things like storing and releasing energy from cells. It is extremely important, and people who have type 1 diabetes don't produce enough of it and must take it to survive. For millions of Americans, taking insulin is not optional, but the sheer cost of the medicine causes people to make dangerous decisions like rationing their supply. State lawmakers are also considering action on capping how much a person should have to spend on life-saving medicine. Nadia Ramlagan has more on one example of those efforts in Ohio.
Nearly 1 million Ohioans have been diagnosed with diabetes, but the cost of insulin continues to be a barrier for people needing the medication. Policy Matters Ohio researcher Catherine Poe says the cost of insulin can reach hundreds of dollars. But with insurance, the range is on average $50 to $80. Poe says the increasing cost of the medication, especially over the past decade, has been driven by three pharmaceutical companies that control the market: Eli Lilly, Novo Nordisk, and Sanofi.
We have a situation where only three companies are able to control basically the global supply of insulin. And in the United States, where there aren't proper checks and balances to regulate these companies, that means that there are unaffordable costs.
Researchers from Yale University found that among people who use insulin, nearly 1.2 million were financially burdened by their healthcare spending over the course of a year. A bipartisan bill filed earlier this year by state house lawmakers would cap out-of-pocket costs for insulin. Poe says if passed, Ohio would follow other states that have passed insulin affordability legislation that caps the cost of copays at around $35 for people with insurance.
The one that's currently introduced in the legislature, HB 384, actually caps the cost of supplies as well, which is really, really important.
While the Inflation Reduction Act capped out-of-pocket insulin costs for Medicare beneficiaries, Poe points out that more than 70% of adults nationwide who reported rationing insulin don't qualify. It's estimated 1 in 5 adults younger than 65 limit their use of the medication because of cost.
The high cost of the actual drug combined with the high cost of supplies has really made this crisis something that definitely kills people. People have lost their lives over this crisis.
But she adds, for those with prescriptions who can afford it, they do have access to an emergency supply if they can't get to a doctor in time to refill. In 2022, Governor Mike DeWine signed a bill into law that allows patients to receive up to 3 emergency refills of life-saving medication within a year without a prescription. Failing to dispense the drug could result in harm to their health. This story was produced in association with Media in the Public Interest and funded in part by the George Gund Foundation. This is Nadia Ramlagan for Ohio News Connection.
The focus on healthcare continues as the Affordable Connectivity Program, which subsidizes internet services for 23 million American households, is expected to run out of funds soon. That subsidy has been vital for providing telehealth services, especially in rural areas. Eric Tegedoff has the details.
The end of internet subsidies for low-income Americans could hurt their access to telehealth, according to reporting from KFF Health News. The Federal Affordable Connectivity Program provides $30 per month to subsidize internet service for 23 million households across the country. But the program is expected to run out of money this month or next. The program has been especially important for people in rural parts of the country, like Cindy Westman, who lives outside Peoria with her 12-year-old daughter, who has cerebral palsy.
Telehealth visits were quite beneficial when doing routine visits, as well as if for any reason my daughter was ill, I could call and they could do an immediate telehealth visit and I didn't have to drag her in if she didn't have COVID and possibly contract it.
Congress created the program in 2021 to bring internet connectivity to more Americans during the pandemic, when internet service was vital. In January, the FCC asked Congress to allocate $6 billion to keep the program running through the end of the year. Westman says telehealth access has been important not just for her daughter, but her as well. Westman is immunocompromised and got an upper respiratory infection when she brought her daughter to the hospital for a COVID test. She says it's not only dangerous, but difficult and costly to get to the hospital.
Given the weather at any time, I would have to get myself together, get my daughter together, put her in the car, go 16 miles one direction just to say she's got a common cold.
Westman says the Affordability Connectivity Program is important simply for staying connected in modern life.
It's going to have a major health impact for people when taking care of themselves and paying attention to the world as far as daily activities with weather, the news.
For Illinois News Connection, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Coast Range Radio. Then at 6, it's Transpositive PDX, and at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Your weather forecast, clear skies tonight with a low of 42. Tomorrow, lots of sunshine and a high of 63. Today in history, in 2018, the New York Times and the New Yorker win the Pulitzer Prize for public service for breaking news of the Harvey Weinstein sexual abuse scandal. The quote of the day is from French poet Anatole France, born this day in 1844. He wrote, quote, "It is human nature to think wisely and to act in an absurd fashion." The Apache Stronghold Coalition asks for the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals to review its case to protect Oak Flat in Arizona against mining. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. On Monday, Apache Stronghold, a coalition of Apache people and their allies, asked all 29 judges on the U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals to review its case to protect Oak Flat in Arizona from a mining project. In March, the group received a blow in its efforts to protect the site after a panel of 11 judges on the court ruled 6-5 that the federal government can transfer Oak Flat to Resolution Copper. The group's trying to prevent the land transfer, saying the project violates religious freedom. Attorneys say Monday's appeal gives the full court one more chance to protect Oak Flat before the case goes to the Supreme Court. The area is sacred to Western Apache and other Native people. In a statement, Dr. Winsler Nosey, senior of Apache Stronghold, said, "Oak Flat is the heart and soul of the Apache, where generations come to connect with their creator and conduct ceremonies." In March, the court ruled the land transfer is not subject to federal laws protecting religious freedom. After that ruling, Resolution Copper welcomed it, saying the project will help supply copper to the U.S., create jobs, and boost Arizona's economy. The Ninth Circuit is expected to decide by the fall whether all 29 judges will rehear the case. Research shows that cultural tourism is on the rise in Indian country because travelers crave authenticity and want deeper experiences with indigenous peoples. As KNBA's Rhonda McBride reports, Alaska tribes could be poised to take advantage of this trend.
Cultural tourism in Alaska can be as simple as a hike on a trail with a native storyteller or a visit to a dance festival. Although it's still in its infancy, Emily Edenshaw says cultural tourism holds a lot of promise for the whole state.
It's a sleeping giant. It's untapped.
Edenshaw is director of the Alaska Native Heritage Center, one of five Native groups across the nation to receive federal money to expand cultural tourism. She says it's an opportunity to rethink tourism in Alaska, which has come to rely too much on wildlife and scenery to draw tourists.
What about the indigenous experience? Our people have been here for 10,000 years.
The Heritage Center will receive about $50,000 to boost tourism. The money comes from the Bureau of Indian Affairs, which has partnered with the American Indian Alaska Native Travel Association to oversee the grants. The association's director, Sherry Rupert, says it's a good time to invest in indigenous tourism.
Visitation to our communities is increasing. That's why we're so interested in supporting efforts up in Alaska, because Alaska has the largest number of federally recognized tribes than any other state. There is so much potential there for these small communities.
Rupert says cultural tourism not only creates jobs and economic opportunity, but also helps tribes hold on to their heritage.
I think it really sparks a light and really sparks that pride in who they are.
Some of the other organizations to receive funding, the St. Regis Mohawk Tribe in New York, the Pine Ridge Area Chamber of Commerce in South Dakota, the Shonto Economic Development Corporation in Arizona, and the Native Hawaiian Hospitality Association in Honolulu. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
University of Utah women's basketball forward Alyssa Peely was picked by the Minnesota Lynx during Monday night's 2024 WNBA draft. From Anchorage, Alaska, she's Alaska Native and Samoan. She's had a large following from the Native community. After her draft pick, ESPN asked what it means to be representing her cultures.
A lot of Indigenous and Polynesian girls don't get to see that role model, and I'm just so blessed that I could be in the position to be that for them.
She was the number 8th overall pick in the 2024 draft. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Wildlife corridors over major highways play a pivotal role in mitigating the adverse effects of climate change and managing surging population growth and terrible conflicts between wildlife and traffic. It's especially apparent in the state of Florida, where a new study is shedding light on just how important those corridors are. Tramell Gomes has that story.
As the Sunshine State grapples with rising temperatures and escalating weather events such as hurricanes, a new study sheds light on the pivotal role of Florida's wildlife corridor in mitigating the effects of climate change, coupled with a surge of new residents. The report is trumpeted as a first-of-its-kind study showcasing how the 18 million acres of the wildlife corridor, which runs through the entire state, ease the worst impact of climate change. It paints a picture of investing in resources that support cohabitation to be mutually beneficial with nature and the economic growth that comes from people who flock to the state to enjoy it. Colin Polsky founded the Florida Atlantic University School of Environmental, Coastal, and Ocean Sustainability, and is the study's lead author. He says the corridor benefits the state.
It's an attempt to welcome the 1,000 people a day, approximately, who move to Florida.
but to do so in a way that allows for the wildlife to continue to thrive.
About 10 million of the 18 million acres of corridor are permanently conserved. The report calls on state leaders to keep working on investing the remaining 8 million. In March, the governor and cabinet touted the state's largest investment in decades, a 25,000-acre acquisition within the Caloosahatchee Big Cypress Corridor. Joshua Daskin is the project manager and director of conservation at Archbold Biological Station. He says that since the corridor effort was steering billions of dollars toward land conservation in the state, the report's focus was on showing the science behind it all.
So climate resilience is one area in which land conservation can help both nature and people, but no one had assembled the state of the science for all the ways that climate resilience can be impacted by land conservation.
The report shows 24% of all Florida properties have a more than 1 in 4 chance of being affected by flooding in the next 30 years. To combat that, one solution is keeping floodplains undeveloped. The corridors have 10 million acres of floodplain. The report also recommends mixed-use development to minimize habitat fragmentation and keep working lands in production. This is Tramell Gomes for Florida News Connection.
The latest phone conversation between President Biden and Chinese President Xi Jinping did not provide any breakthroughs in U.S.-China relations, but as Xi said, relations have stabilized. Even so, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen's follow-up trip to China was not so successful. Now we go to global citizen commentary on that issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. By the way, the opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. High-level U.S.-China diplomacy has resumed. The two presidents held a telephone conversation April 2nd, and each government posted a readout of it. The U.S. readout was fairly brief, noting that, quote, a candid and constructive discussion on a range of bilateral, regional, and global issues had taken place. The list began with issues on which some progress has been achieved: counter-narcotics cooperation, military-to-military talks, climate change, and people-to-people exchanges. President Biden also raised long-standing sources of disagreement: Taiwan, the South China Sea, China's support of Russia's military machine, denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, Chinese trade practices. The readout ends with a renewed commitment to high-level diplomacy, with visits by Secretary of the Treasury Janet Yellen, which has now taken place, and Secretary of State Antony Blinken. China's much longer readout begins with Xi saying that relations have stabilized, but important negative developments need attention. Strategically, the bottom line, it says, should be no conflict, no confrontation. Keeping the relationship on a stable course is very important, he stressed, which means elevating trust, abiding by mutual respect, and promoting more exchanges. Then Xi launched into China's complaints, starting with the U.S. adhering to its promise not to support Taiwan's independence and the U.S. stopping its regulations and sanctions on high-tech exports. As for other issues, such as human rights in Hong Kong, the readout merely said Xi elaborated on them. The readout also reported Biden's comments, but only those that stressed agreement with Xi, such as on Taiwan independence, avoidance of a Cold War with China, and not seeking to contain China. In all, the conversation didn't advance cooperation on the issues that divide the U.S. and China, but neither did it introduce new complications. At best, it continued the series of top-level communications that started in Bali and San Francisco, and that's certainly a good thing. Jaw-jaw is better than war-war, as Churchill famously said, or, as Chinese officials are now saying uniformly, relations with the U.S. have stabilized. Yet, when Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen quickly followed up the Biden-Xi conversation with her visit to China, we saw that stability doesn't exclude friction. As the New York Times reported, Yellen lodged a direct complaint. Cheap Chinese exports of green energy technology are threatening the electric vehicle and solar sectors that the U.S. has been trying to develop. The new push against China's exports threatens to inflame trade tensions between the world's largest economies, just as they have been working to stabilize relations, unquote. My two takeaways from the U.S. complaint. First is the contradiction in U.S. policy between urging China to damp down its green exports while the U.S. subsidizes its own green industries. I guess the Treasury Secretary rejects globalization when it doesn't serve U.S. purposes. Second is the bizarre notion that the spread of EVs and solar energy is a good idea, but not if China is behind it. Isn't capitalism about competition? If China is building a better or at least cheaper mousetrap and lots of people are buying it, shouldn't we find ways to match it? Maybe get Elon Musk to lower the price of Tesla? That's the way things are supposed to work, or so I thought. Yellen's advice to China is to focus on consumer demand rather than on exports and stop subsidizing industries that otherwise might fail. Well, you can imagine the Chinese reaction to a foreigner's, especially an adversary's, advice, probably about the same as would be her reaction if a Chinese official made suggestions for improving the U.S. economy. In fact, China's Commerce Minister Wang Wentao disputed the idea of overcapacity, calling it groundless. He touted China's contribution to fighting climate change through its green exports, saying, quote, "The Chinese government will fully support and defend the rights of the industry because our electric vehicle development has made important contributions in the process of the world's green transitioning," unquote. Wang also defended the EV industry against the charge that its successes were due to government subsidies, saying, quote, "China's electric vehicle companies are competitive due to the innovation of technology and comprehensiveness of its supply chain network." What really concerns the Chinese is that their EVs will become subject to high tariffs in Europe, where they are flooding the market and challenging German-made and other EVs. To be sure, overcapacity is a problem for China, and exporting as a way out of it is a time-worn solution that may not work for long. European Union countries are the leading complainers, and Chinese EVs are complicating their relations with Europe. But let the Chinese figure that one out, and let Yellen get back to the business of business at home. I'm Mel Gertow for The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, April 16, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories, tips, and ideas at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertow. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegadoff, Antonia Gonzalez, Edwin J. Vieira, Tramel Gomes,